in. And I thought it'd be interesting to discuss Morocco. Kathy mentioned last week, you know, you want to go to Morocco. I've been very interested always in going to Morocco. Sue went to Morocco. You were there for how many days?
9 days.
9 days. And I happened to meet Reda, and I met him at the Tribute to the Stones. That was happening, the Exiles on Maui show. And found out he's a neighbor. He literally is right around the corner here. He owns Evolution Yoga Studio. And congratulations on that. Are you how many years? About a year?
About a year. We opened December 5th, 2017.
And I found out that you actually were born in Morocco.
Yes.
And you have family there still.
Yes. My siblings and mom still live there.
So we thought we'd dedicate the show to Morocco. And I want you to chirp in with questions too, Kathy. But I thought it'd be interesting, having been born in Morocco, in Casablanca?
In Casablanca, yes.
Which is an interesting place because that's kind of an international city, right?
Yes, so there's it's a melting pot. And you have influence from Africa, Europe, the Middle East, you know, and now more so since, I would say, the early 90s, the United States. So it's a very interesting place to be.
And how many times have you seen Casablanca? You know, I mean, you can't get away from that movie, right?
You can't. I mean, I've seen it as a child, you know, and we were talking about that last week, and it's so funny that there is an American expat in Casablanca that opened a Rick's Cafe. Mm-hmm. That is just beautiful, in mm-hmm. a beautiful area in the city.
And probably all tourists. Did you go there, Sue?
We did go there, but unfortunately it was 11 a.m. and they weren't open for lunch yet, so we took a picture standing out front. So okay. Anyways, but yeah, that was the day we started at the mosque in Casablanca, mm-hmm. which Reda and I were talking about earlier. It was built by the king and all the people of Morocco, I'm assuming, or is it just Casablanca?
All the people of Morocco.
Morocco contributed to it, and it holds 25,000 worshippers. So it's beautiful. It has water features and the marble.
It's got to be huge.
It is. It's huge, and it's right on the Atlantic Ocean. It's a beautiful setting. It's really gorgeous. And in Morocco, if you're not Muslim, you cannot go into a mosque. This is the only one that you can tour, and they have tours at 10 a.m. in the morning, in different languages, and it's an hour tour, and it was really very, very interesting about the construction and everything. So it's a beautiful building.
So let's start with the basis. Obviously, Morocco, I would imagine, is mainly a Muslim country.
Mainly Muslim country, and I think the 1%, so mostly I would say 99% is Muslim. Then you have 0.5% of there are Jewish Moroccans and Christian expatriates.
Mm-hmm. So. And they would worship at a few
churches and synagogues.
Mm-hmm. You know. But because it's such an international city, it seems like they have been able to be beyond or a little bit above, and we talked a little bit before the show about this, how they've been able to avoid a lot of the problems that the rest of the Muslim countries have experienced there. That seems like people get along real well, and you haven't had any major incidents, and that they've seemed to be able to get past the hatreds and the bigotry that some places might have.
It's Morocco is a slightly different place because there is a thing in the culture that you take a lot of pride in being Moroccan. So you're representing a country, you're representing the people of Morocco, and it is it's unfathomable actually to do something of that nature in your own country.
Hmm.
So I don't know if that makes sense, like
from
a cultural standpoint. But
it'd be like Maui, someone not having aloha or not having the aloha spirit, that in Morocco you've got your own way of living and the people have a certain standard that you live by, right?
Basically, yes. And there is a lot of pride in the culture.
And as a visitor there, I felt that. People are mm-hmm. very proud of their country. The two gentlemen that we were with, our driver and guide, were Berber. And, I mean, the Berbers are just really proud to be Berbers, you know, that heritage and the period of time that the Berbers have been living in the desert and everything. But I found that too. Everybody was very proud of their country there.
But the sects don't, and there are different, we mentioned the Berbers, there's other groups and sects, and they don't clash either, do they?
No, because the fact of being Moroccan comes above ethnic differences or tribal differences. You're Moroccan first, then you're Berber second, or you're Arab second, or European. But being Moroccan comes first.
Could I correlate this to Ethiopia? Ethiopia, mm-hmm. Ethiopia, of course, the pride, and we all know Bob Marley and you know, the whole mm-hmm. standard that reggae was founded on, of course, had some extremely strong principles of love mm-hmm. and the good vibes and the whole energy of what was done. So there are a few places where that understanding of what it is to be a good country, a good person, and have high standards seem to come above what the pettiness that might separate a country might, and in many places does separate a country, your understanding of what it takes to be a Moroccan. And I guess the next question would be, what is it? What were you raised with? What principles of being a Moroccan did you feel growing up?
You know, one of the main things when you're raised as a Moroccan is hospitality. Mm. Hospitality and sharing. So you can, even if I have, let's say, a bowl of rice, I will share it with you. So that's a very, very important as in our identity, is having that sense of hospitality and having that sense of sharing and always being grateful for what we have. You know, and there is actually a saying that it's mostly Persian, but we use it a lot in our culture as well. And if I translate it correctly, it goes this way. It's, I curse the fact that I had no shoes until I saw the man that had no feet. Mm-hmm. So that's like, this is a very important thing in our culture where no matter what our problem is, somebody else has it worse, and we always have to be grateful and kind. You have to be kind, and that's the greatest gift you can share with other human beings.
I had a chance to have a meal with you you had a cup of coffee and I had a shake mm-hmm. at Wailuku Coffee Company, and you told me an interesting fact, which totally makes sense and I think is part of the culture, about breaking bread and sharing a meal with someone and what that means in Morocco and in your culture.
So if we break bread, that's where there's a bond between us that can't, we're brothers, we're linked forever. So that's a very, very sacred, breaking bread is very sacred in terms of there is no, you can't betray the person you have broken bread with. You know, it's just like, it's very sacred, and it's a way, for example, if you want to seal a deal or something, you break bread, you share a meal, then you can't go back on your word.
This sounds like something that would be almost 1,000, 2,000 years old. This sounds to me something that is so authentically ingrained in, that would have existed maybe 1,000, 2,000 years ago, that could be really in your DNA. That this was something that was existing, right?
Definitely. And there is one thing that happens around the table is that even, so we can, I'll give you an example. If you have your worst enemy come in and is hungry and it's time to eat, you share food with your worst enemy, all differences are put aside.
Wow.
You know, so at that moment where it's time to sit and share, it goes way above any kind of differences or disagreements we might have.
Wow, I think this needs to be done in Israel and Palestine, right?
Yeah.
This could be. Maybe the whole world.
Maybe the whole world. Thank you, Sue.
I'm just going to interject real quick, too. Mm-hmm. One of the things I loved about traveling in Morocco is wherever you go, you are greeted with Moroccan mint tea, mm-hmm. you know, And that's the hospitality. You walk into a Riyadh or anywhere we went, we were given Moroccan mint tea and sweets immediately, and that was a really nice welcome.
And the sweets would be?
They're local sweets. Probably Retta could explain them better, but they're amazing. I mean, I don't know what's in them, but they're really good. But really good cookies and, yeah.
It's totally true. Like a lot of sweets, so mint tea is already sweet. And then you have these cookies that are like filled with mint paste and you
almonds
have dry cookies,
and,
like you name it. And that's a way, that's another, like, to put the parallel with what we were just speaking about, that's a greeting way, but it's also like you're, you know, welcome, and you're part of this mm-hmm. big thing that mm-hmm. is bigger than any one of us, you know. And I'm sure you've experienced that when you went into the market.
Absolutely, yeah. Everyone's really willing to welcome you and share. Even if you went in to buy something or just look at something, they offered you mint tea immediately. And brought it out with a, you know, plate of cookies. And it's really a wonderful tradition. And when you checked into a Riyadh, their accommodations there, you would sit down on these big overstuffed couches and you didn't worry about going to your room. Your bags disappeared and they went to your room and Moroccan mint tea came out with sweets. So I was like, nice. Yeah, this is good.
Okay, let's talk about there's a rather famous, I guess, should we say reputation or rumors and stories about when Mick Jagger and the whole era of that time when Mick Jagger and the Stones and many musicians were going to Morocco and getting rather stoned, you know, and hashish and getting into that whole thing. But some of it was videotaped. There were movies done around it. And there was this whole era where people got this impression, if you want to go and be a hippie and get stoned, you go to Morocco because, like, that's a super cool place to do that. And that was an interesting time. And I imagine it was the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Do the after effects and the stories of that, I mean, and the culture around that kind of remain? Or something that made a lasting impression on people?
Definitely. Like growing up, the generation, I mean, my generation, for example, was very, very influenced by everything that happened in the 70s in Morocco. Very much so. And to this day, if you go in the south to Essaouira, for example, there is a very, like, remnants of that era. You know, in the music, in how the young generation, like, I mean, the younger generation still listens to the Stones
mm-hmm.
or Jimi Hendrix,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's very fascinating, like, just to have grown up in that, you know, and having that fascination with, you know, something just as simple as the Rolling Stones. If we take the Rolling Stones, for example, I mean, there is a huge chunk of my generation that really idolize the Stones.
Mm-hmm. And for good reason. I mean, it did make a huge influence. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of talk about that at the same time. This was happening. This was like a huge deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then, how do you get past that image and to the image where now, like Sue's experience, where people are traveling and they're not going to rent a villa and all, you know, some of these people would go and just have a party, a constant, nonstop party, you know. How did it evolve from that when you were growing up and seeing people come and go, the flow from that to a place where now people come for what the number one reason they come for? Is it tourism now, the number one?
I do believe it's the culture.
The culture?
I do believe so, yeah. Culture and sightseeing. I mean, before it was just the hippie trail, where you would go from Tangiers into the mountains, the reef mountains where the hash crop was very predominant, and then you go down the south. Then you hang out in the south and get blasted. But now it's more of like, you know, with Facebook, with Instagram, with all these things, people are starting to see the richness of that culture. The culture, the landscapes, I mean, it's a country that is the size of California, but with so many microclimates and so many different landscapes.
So we kind of think of it as the desert, but it's more than the desert.
There is snow.
Yeah. There's snow.
Yeah. And there's a village that has, they have a ski resort and they have chalets. When you go there, you think you're in Switzerland, right?
Definitely.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
It is a very diverse landscape. I mean, it's kind of like Maui where we have all our little microclimates.
Uh-huh.
Morocco is the same way. You can be in the desert. You can be in the mountains. You can be in these gorgeous gorges. There's mm-hmm. incredible gorges. There's oases in the middle of the desert. I mean, every corner has something different to look at, I think. You know, it was amazing, you know. But there is snow there, too, so.
So do people now, I mean, it sounds like from what Sue even did in her 9 days, and as tourism does start to, and it seems like there's more people who are coming as tourists. I think, Kathy, there's some cruises that are making a point of now going to, are there some cruises going to Morocco?
There are. They stop maybe in Casablanca maybe for a day.
Uh-huh.
But
they
know,
don't
that,
really.
You don't want to, yeah. Mm-hmm. You need to go there, which I want to go.
Spend time.
Like 9-10 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to mm-hmm. go to the Blue City.
Yeah. And we. I was just talking also before the show began, I've been watching the Jack Ryan series and it's really well done. But it looks like a lot of the scenes are supposed to be in Syria and other places, but I look and it's done and shot in Morocco. And I guess you said that there's a burgeoning film business going on, which, of course, is we're talking big bucks when they're mm-hmm. doing a whole motion picture series or miniseries or movies done there. And you say many movies are now being shot there in Morocco.
Yes, in southern Morocco, there's like studios there. There's a bunch of studios. And Sue, you went there. And
yeah, we went to one of them. Yeah, it's amazing because you see all the miniature Sphinx and pyramids and stuff that they use in the movies as props and things. But yeah, it's right in the desert and with a beautiful 5-star hotel attached to the studio lot. So
wow.
And that's where all the actors stay. And yeah.
That'd be a cool thing to do.
Yeah,
go down and spend mm-hmm. a night down there
and
see it.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. Yeah, we stopped and had lunch there. So.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, it was neat.
That's great. And so... So there's more income coming in. Do people go, are there concert festivals? Are there music festivals being happening there now?
Yes, there is. There's at least 3 or 4 music festivals that I know of. One is in Essaouira, which is, there is this traditional music in southern Morocco called Gnawa music, which is music with influences from Africa. And so every year since 1999, they started doing this awesome festival where there's fusion music, where they merge traditional Gnawa music with different, you know, jazz.
World music.
Yes.
And
you have a lot of great musicians. And I think one of the first musicians that showed up for one of those festivals was Randy Weston. It's like a jazz pianist, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken.
I think Peter Gabriel did some work.
Peter Gabriel as well.
Yeah,
yes.
Did some work. And he was he had a world music whole studio and he did a whole series, I think.
Yes, definitely.
And good drummers, you know, even Mick Fleetwood and others have learned a lot from the drumming
mm-hmm.
because there's really a different style of drumming and music that comes from Morocco, isn't there?
Yeah.
Northern Morocco.
Northern Morocco
has a place called Jajouka where the drumming has its own specific pattern. And again, going back to the Stones, Brian Jones went there and he recorded those that tribe.
Really?
Yes. Wow. You know, and there is a recording from the 70s called The Master Musicians of Jajouka.
Oh, really?
So if you get your hands on that, it's an interesting thing to listen to from, you know.
Right. And I was just going to say, we had the opportunity to hear a Gnawan group. We went to a village in the desert and mm-hmm. they played for us. And it's really amazing music. I probably have a video on my phone of it, but really amazing music. So we got to experience that. And of course, we had the green mint tea, too.
Is that when you went to spent the night in the desert, right?
It was actually the day before we spent the night in the desert. We actually went to our guide's family's home in his village. And on the way out of his village, because the road dead ends at his village, we stopped at a Gnawan village. And we got to meet the people in the village, and then they performed for us. So, yeah. It was pretty neat experience. But it is, and they did talk about that music festival. It's very popular there, very big. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and I think that's coming up.
I think it happened not long ago.
Yeah, right? I think it was just right after we were there, right before we were there, I think it happened, yeah.
June, July or something like that. Then there is another one in Fez that it's sacred music from around the world. That's another festival. Then there's a jazz festival in Rabat, which is the capital. So it's the music scene is interesting, very good.
So for people going to Morocco, people like Kathy and myself and Sue, there's obviously people that want to go and want to make sure they have, and I think more and more people want an authentic experience. And I think that we see this around the world more and more. People are trying to travel, which is sometimes hard to do if you're doing a tour. So you have to kind of carefully figure out how you have that experience, where you decide to go, and how much freedom you leave within the room of doing it. So I guess we'll ask you, Sue, when you were going, you'd already come and gone to Portugal and a river cruise and gone to Spain and then went down to the south of Spain. You did Madrid in the south of Spain, and then you went over to Morocco. How did you plan, you know, knowing you wanted to go to Morocco, how did you plan your trip to Morocco?
Okay, so what I basically did was I kind of knew we wanted to go there for X amount of time and drive around the country. So I actually went online and I found a company there. It's called Trips to Morocco. And I read the reviews, the TripAdvisor reviews, and they got really good reviews. So I contacted the gentleman that owns the business. His name is Mohammed. He's a Berber, and he's from the southern part of Morocco, down in the desert area. And he got back to me right away, and we talked about what we wanted to do, and he put this itinerary together, quoted us a price, and we decided to go for it. And, you know, I'm thinking, okay, you know, this might happen or might not happen. And we just had to give him a deposit, and the balance was due when we got there. So I thought that was really fair. And when we got there, we were met at the airport in Casablanca by a driver who took us to a hotel right on the Atlantic Ocean, and we spent the night there because we got in a day early. And then the next morning at 9 a.m., when he said the driver and the guide would be there, they were waiting for us in the lobby, and we checked out and got in the vehicle, and we spent the next 9 days with him driving around Morocco. And it was all very well organized, and every place we went, we had a local guide, like in Fez and in Marrakesh, people who knew the city really well, rather than the driver and the guide that we had. They knew the desert really well because that's where they were from. So I have to say it was a really wonderful educational and cultural experience to spend the day with a local guide. And it was just my husband and I, the two of us. So it was really nice. And it was a great experience all the way along. So,
and you stayed, what were the places you stayed at?
Well, you know, he organized all that, and you can kind of give him an idea, you know, price-wise, you want a 3-star, 4-star, 5-star. And, you know, we kind of picked the mid-range 4-star. And everywhere we went, we had a riad, which are, you know, old buildings that don't look like anything from outside, right? They're covered in mud, and you go inside, and they're palatial. They're beautiful. Mm. So all the riads that we stayed at were really fabulous. I have to say they were really, really well thought out.
And how's the pricing compared to, I would imagine most people going have done trips to Europe before and gone to European places. It's a deal. It's a deal.
Okay, we spent for 9 days, 9 nights accommodations with a driver and a guide. All the things that we did, the tours, we did get to ride camels into the desert, spend the night in a fabulous desert camp, come back out. It was $1,250 a person.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. And it was a very good deal. It was all pretty first class. I have to say that all the way. Yeah. So it was really good value. Yeah.
So as a Moroccan, let's go down and do notes. And you lived there till, when did you leave Morocco?
I left in 1999, but I would go like to visit my family.
You know, your family's in Casablanca still.
Yeah.
And you've seen changes, I would imagine, quite a bit of changes because of tourism, right?
A lot
of changes.
Yeah.
So, do you feel like it's still an authentic experience for you when you go back, or you feel like I've got to get out of the city and go to some other place, you know, that to actually experience the way I grew up?
Actually, you know, growing up in Casablanca, it's the same as growing up in any big city.
Mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, 70 to 80% of the economy is in that axle between Casablanca and Rabat. And as soon as you leave, you step into time. Yeah. It's really fascinating to see that, like, you drive 3 hours, it's almost like you're back 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we experienced that once we left Casablanca, went to Meknes, which we stepped down a little bit there, and then to Fez. And then after you left Fez, it was, we were in the desert with nomads and, you know, small tribal villages and things like that. Yeah, so it really is. And people don't have cars. I mean, they're using donkeys. You know, that's how they're getting around, you know. So it's, yeah, once you get out of the cities, and even Fez, to me, in the Medina, was really a step back in time. Like the tanneries where they process all the leather, and I mean, that's quite an experience unto itself. So, yeah.
What would be some tips that you might give people listening, and to me and to Kathy and those that would think, well, this might be a great adventure? What would be the tips you'd give to go to places that you might not necessarily know about if you would just go to TripAdvisor?
I would say to keep an open mind. To keep an open mind, and also giving people a chance, because not necessarily, you know, most of the time as travelers, we think that we're going to be ripped off by so-and-so or this or that or scammed. But, you know, if you keep an open mind and just being relaxed about it.
And smile.
And smile. And it'll go a long
bring
way.
Bring macadamia nuts.
Yeah. Bring macadamia nuts, yes. If you have something sweet, you're good. And, you know, and also having the ability to get off the beaten path and just go explore. There are some magical places.
Can you give us a couple of places that you think are magical that people might not normally know about?
There is this place in the south on the coast called Mirlift. And that's such a beautiful place. So there is not, you know, it's not
and that's
very developed.
M-I-R?
M-I-R-L-E-F-T.
Mirlift.
Mirlift. That's a beautiful, beautiful place.
And it's a beach. Is a resort community? Beach community? What is the kind of community?
It's a beach community, and the landscape is just magical.
Really?
Yes.
What's it like?
It's just this, like, I mean, I surf, obviously, so it's a lot of surf spots, but it's just beautiful. It's there's just these beautiful cliffs, and it's like this open ocean. Mm. It's beautiful, and there is also a in that area, there is this white sand beach.
Mm.
You know, so that's one of my favorite places in Morocco. And another place, I mean, there are a lot of people from Maui that actually go to one of the southernmost tips in Morocco called Dakhla. Yeah. That is a high hub for kite surfing.
Oh, really?
Yes. So
this is, of course, another whole subculture we haven't done a lot of talk about, but there's a huge, huge group of people that surf, and some professionally, and there's all the surf events as well.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who just go, and just like people who come here to go surfing. There's people that go to places like that to go surfing, right?
Oh, there is an
international community of surfers, right?
There's a whole subculture of surfers, wind surfers, kite surfers that make a point of going there and just spend a bunch of months.
Really, months
on the
there?
Road. Yeah, wow. In Morocco.
Really?
Yeah, I think that the surfers know Morocco really well, because we've heard that a lot from a lot of people. Mm-hmm. One of the other things too that, and Retta will probably bear me out on this, but it's very easy for Europeans to get to Morocco because it's so close to Europe. And there are people just coming over in their four-wheel drive vehicles, and they're driving all
over
the desert.
Taking a ferry from Gibraltar, basically?
Yeah, and they're free traveling in the country, and they're driving through the desert in their four-wheel drive vehicles, and they're hiking in the High Atlas. So there are a lot of people coming there, because it's very easy if you're in Europe to bring your vehicle over. And
obviously it's more affordable than Italy and France.
Absolutely,
and places,
yeah. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of free travelers there.
That's a good point. We haven't talked about the High Atlas. Let's talk about that.
Well, the High Atlas area, too, is where we were talking about. They do get snow there, and there's a ski resort.
Is that where Winston Churchill went to paint? There was, I think Winston Churchill went to Morocco to paint the mountains sometimes, and I think it may have been there. I kind of think it was there that he went to paint.
Kind of interesting because you have the whole mountain range, so it's High Atlas to Mid Atlas to Anti-Atlas. And the higher you are, then the more barren the landscape is. And we saw a lot of sheep herders. And we stopped along the road and talked to them, and they let us, you know, hang out with them and stuff, and that was kind of fun. It was particularly nice having the two, our guide and our driver, because they obviously speak the language. So they would take us into some really interesting local experiences, so we got to experience a lot of things with them just along the road. And then, you know, we get into the Mid-Atlas, I think, Retta, is where all the gorges are. They're the most beautiful carved gorges in the mountains there. You can drive up and look down on these gorges that, you know, and they're real windy roads and everything to get up there, but they're spectacularly beautiful, and the water is turquoise blue coming down from the mountains through these streams and stuff. And that was a particularly beautiful section of Morocco, I thought, through the Mid-Atlas Mountains and stuff. And then from there you kind of get into the desert area, which is where we did our camel trip. And, you know, one of the neat things about the camel trip was we had a camel man with us. It was just the two of us. And, I mean, this is what this man has done his whole life and probably every generation before. They live in the desert in a little village in a little, you know, tent with their camels. And the camels are so important to them. They have a language they speak with their camels.
Camels go for a lot of money. I was watching something on TV, but I was surprised how much camels are expensive.
Well, this is kind of interesting because people aren't using camels that much anymore because there aren't the caravans. Oh. They're using them for tourists to actually go into the desert, and they've built these really nice camps in the desert, all different levels, 3-star, 4-star, 5-star, whatever, you name it.
Is that glamping?
Definitely glamping, yeah. And in fact, I'll tell you about our experience. But anyways, you know, we got on the camels at the end of the day, and we rode out for sunset, and then we went out to the camp. And we got there, it was dark, and there was no lights on in the camp. And I said to Dart, I go, I don't think there's anybody here, you know. So the camel man, at this point it's dark, he lays out his blanket, and he brings out all his little trinkets that he has to sell, like carved camels and, you know, different things like that. He wants us to buy something because you do have the option. If you don't ride the camel back in the morning, they'll come out and pick you up and drive you back through the desert to where your driver will pick you up. So I think he thought maybe we wouldn't get back on the camels in the morning. So we said, no, we'll see you in the morning. And all of a sudden, a man appeared with a turban and a caftan on and said, welcome. And we went up, and there was our mint tea on a nice nice cushy couches. And then he took us to our tent, which was amazing. King-size bed and, you know, hot showers. The whole.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it was amazing. We were the only two people there. So he asked us, what time do you want dinner? And we had two very handsome young men waiting on us and cooking for us, and we had a fabulous dinner under the stars, and we spent the night there.
How wonderful.
And then we got up at 5 a.m. and watched sunrise over the desert, and then we had breakfast, and our camel man spent the night with the camels, and we got on our camels and rode back. So it was a really, really interesting experience, but it was just the two of us. So
have you ever ridden a camel?
Yes.
Okay, that's funny.
Yeah, you know, and...
But what kind of camel experience have you had?
You know, it was just mostly as a tourist person.
Yeah.
You know, especially in the south of Morocco, that's where you would find that. You know, and going, it's a thing to do.
It's the thing to do.
What I love, or why I want to go to Morocco, is when you see those pictures. I see them a lot of the herd of camels, and they're all in the
silhouettes,
the sand dunes.
Yes.
Well, like, and that was the experience we had, because we went to I think it's called Erb Chebbi. It's a beautiful dune system. They're reds and oranges and yellows, golden. So when the sun's setting or the sun is rising, the colors are just amazing. And we got some incredible.
How many pictures did you take?
A lot.
Thousands and thousands of pictures that now you got to sort through them all, right?
Yeah.
Was it mostly on your phone?
We had a phone and a camera.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we did both. But yeah, that was a fun experience. And like I said, the camel man, it was interesting. We came back from the camel ride in the morning, and he has a language that he used with the camel to get them to sit down on the ground so he can get off. So Dart got off his camel, and I'm just about to step off my camel, and it was on the ground, and I decided to pop back up. And Retta can bear me up, but camels, when you get on them, they lift their back ends up first and then their front ends, so you have to really hold on because it's like you're getting thrown one way and thrown the other way. And so anyways, I said to the camel man, uh-oh, you know. He came back, and he did this little and then the camel went back down. So, yeah, just an incredible experience.
They tell you when they're not happy, too.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we've got to talk about the cuisine, the Moroccan cuisine. Now, I mean, it seems like it's a combination of Middle Eastern and Mediterranean food. And when you have a feast, a gathering, what is served?
So when you have a feast, you have a lot of salads. That's the first thing. Then you have what we call a pigeon pie, chicken pie, which is a sweet and savory dish with phyllo dough here, the closest thing that would be comparable to the little pastry that they do is phyllo dough, and it's filled with a mixture of chicken, almonds, cinnamon, sugar, you know, and then it's dusted with powdered sugar and cinnamon.
Kind of like baklava, but with chicken. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm. And then you have a bunch of tagines and most.
What's tagines or?
Tagine is a clay pot where you cook a mixture of vegetables, meat. So the name refers to the vessel, but it also refers to the dish itself.
Like when you go and have a clay pot dish at a Vietnamese restaurant.
Basically.
It's a clay pot, but the different things inside.
Well, yes and no, because the tagine is conical shaped.
Oh.
So they put all the foods in there with just a little bit of moisture, and then when you cook it, it steams everything in there. Ah. And it infuses all the flavors, and it's amazing. So there's lamb, there's seafood, there's chicken, vegetarian, and then everything, of course, comes with couscous, which is amazing. We've never had couscous in this country like they have over there.
Really?
Yeah, it's amazing.
And then it's funny because growing up in Hollywood, there was a Moroccan restaurant where all the heavy-duty musicians and PR people would go. It was right on Sunset Boulevard, and it was like the place to go. And you'd go in, and it was all Moroccan-style architecture, and you'd go in and sit on the ground, you'd sit around the table, and you all had these amazing cushions, and then a central dish in the middle, and I think you ate with your hands, but did you serve out of one central dish and then you all take from the central dish or not?
Yes.
You do?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And that's part of sharing food.
The food.
Yeah. And you know, it's a cultural thing. So most of the time you will accommodate people if they ask, but most of the time you're going to eat from a communal dish. Mm-hmm. And just that's the way it is. You eat with your hands. Mm-hmm. And I mean, more so now, if you go to Casablanca, people are going to eat with utensils. But traditionally, you eat a tagine, you know, you're gonna eat with your hands, scooping, like, using the bread.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And the bread is made in ovens, flatbread, or what kind of bread?
It's Moroccan bread is, you know, I wouldn't consider it as a flatbread. What would you think? So what would you compare it to?
It's has more of a rise to it. Mm-hmm. It's not a flatbread. It has more of a rise to it, but it's not like a loaf of bread either. It's somewhere.
Would it be like an Indian?
No, it's different because they use the ones we experienced were a lot of whole wheat grains mm-hmm. in and stuff. And so it has a different density and texture. It's not a flatbread, and it's not like a raised loaf of bread. It's somewhere in between. But they bake it all the time and in traditional clay ovens and stuff too. So
outdoor ovens and ovens that mm-hmm. are
or communal oven. Like you take your bread to the communal oven and the guy remembers every single loaf from every single
really?
Family.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating thing. And
again, going back probably centuries and
Probably so.
We saw that actually. People bring their dough and they bake it and they come back. We saw a gentleman in the Medina in Fez with a board on his head with just 100 loaves of bread sitting on top of it, walking through the Medina with tons of people and donkeys and everything else. So that was kind of interesting. But they do. Communal bakeries.
I like that. I like that very much. Why don't you open a Moroccan restaurant here? We don't have a Moroccan restaurant.
That's true. We don't.
He specializes in yoga.
I know, but it could be yoga.
I used to be a chef.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, I used to be a Moroccan chef before yoga.
Where? Did you cook?
I was in France, Switzerland, Ireland.
You didn't mention that. This is a travel show. Where did you do it in France?
East Coast.
Where in France?
In Montpellier.
Oh, that's a very expensive area.
Yeah.
Is that a ski community?
No, that's in the southeast, just below the Alps. And it's where I went to college. And, you know, like every kid started cooking.
I don't know if every kid starts cooking.
I started cooking Moroccan food and I'd never looked back. And after I graduated college.
Did you cook in any of the restaurants there?
Oh, yeah. I cooked in restaurants, and after that, I just packed the knives and went to Switzerland, cooked in a Moroccan restaurant there for a couple of years.
Oh, my gosh. Where in Switzerland?
Geneva.
Oh, Geneva. Yeah. Very high end.
Yeah, that was
a lot of chocolate.
It was an awesome experience. A lot of chocolate, a lot of really learned quite a bit about that, and then came to the U.S., worked on the East Coast.
In restaurants?
Yeah, then went to Ireland.
Where in the East Coast?
I worked in North Carolina.
North Carolina?
Of all places, yeah. That's what happens when you follow a girl.
That's why he's been on this path, right?
Yeah, you know.
And then you go back to where?
I went to Ireland.
Ireland?
Yes.
Where in Ireland?
Outside of Cork.
Oh, down south.
Down south, yeah. And there just taught Moroccan cookery, North
Africa.
Well,
see, that's one thing. When you're a chef, you can travel. And you can go wherever you want. And you can get jobs if you're a good chef, right?
You can get a job anywhere. If you can cook, you have a great tool.
That's a very good point. Like you said, you get your knives.
And you just keep going.
Yeah, exactly.
That's
you still have your knives?
Still, yeah. So now my wife gets to enjoy.
She gets to use your knives? So.
Not even.
She
eats. She eats. But to go back to the cuisine, I just thought about that. If you think about it, the melting pot of cultures. So you have the Middle East Persian culture where you see the food that is sweet and salty, sweet and savory. Mm-hmm. Then you have the Mediterranean influence. Mm-hmm. You have the African influence. And it's really fascinating to see that from city to city. Like the cuisine of Marrakech is going to be slightly different from the cuisine of Fez.
Really?
That is slightly different from the cuisine of Casablanca. And people take pride in the regional dishes.
And down south, different.
Down south, different.
And up in the Atlas.
Tangiers, different. You know, so. But it's a universe of its own, you know. But it's fascinating to understand, like, to look at the history. You can see the history through the dishes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just part of the culture and part of what you talked about, which is bringing people together.
Definitely.
And again, if you're breaking bread and you're sharing that part of the culture through the food, it adds to that because you're bringing the culture in with the understanding of being able to connect with that person through breaking bread. And then the bread being so different as well. Because, like, I mean, the way you were describing it, Sue, I don't think I've had a bread like that.
Yeah, I'm trying to see what I could compare it to. But it's definitely not a flatbread, and it's definitely not a high-rise bread. It's somewhere not in between. It's probably like, I'm holding my fingers out here, but dome-shaped, and maybe 3 to 4 inches in the middle. Yeah, so it's round and dome-shaped.
And kind of heavy, or like sourdough consistency? Or
no not heavy. Not heavy.
Interesting. I think we had something similar to that in Egypt. It was kind of a thicker.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. It is similar to the Egyptian bread, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then again, with all the influences that you have in Morocco, so close to, which is such an interesting place itself. Gibraltar, of course, had all the English influence there, you know, and international cuisine and the English influence. You go to Gibraltar and you see fish and chip places, right? I mean, it's exactly. Like, well, what? You know, like there's all that English kind of tea rooms even in Gibraltar still, you know, so it's like, and some English accents and things too. So you have all of that and the different cultures merging and blending in an interesting way. We haven't talked about zoos, and we only have a couple minutes left. What about the animal wildlife they're good zoos, and is there different wildlife that people go to appreciate and understand? Are there wild animal parks?
There is a bird refuge in southern Morocco. I don't know if you had the chance to go there. So it's called Wad Massa, and it's beautiful. Like, if you're a bird lover, that's like
I am
paradise.
A bird lover. Yeah, I love birds.
Yeah, you would love that. And, I mean, people don't think of Morocco with pink flamingos. But you have that, like, there. It's a lot of things. Unfortunately, zoos, there is a couple of zoos in Morocco, but nothing.
I think there's one in Marrakesh, but we didn't go to that. Yeah.
It's not part of the culture of, like, going to the zoo and all that. Yeah.
But then you grow up with the camels.
And, you know, in the Atlas Mountains, there's an interesting animal, like, there's interesting wildlife there, you know.
And probably wild birds.
Yeah, wild birds as well, yeah.
If you have different kind of cultures and different heights and the different altitudes are going to have different, Well, you know, there's so much to learn about. It's such a fascinating look, and I really appreciate you telling us your personal perspective and yours. And I have to say that you found a good thing. And the Berbers, as we wind it up here in the last minute, what is the unique thing about Berbers versus other people in the Berber culture?
What I found about them is they're very friendly and very welcoming, because we did get to go to some of their homes, and they were very. And I was telling Retta earlier, we were there during Ramadan, and I didn't know it was Ramadan, and they fast all day. So, you know, they invite you into their home during the day, and they provide you with food even though they're fasting. That's talking once again about sharing food and, you know, showing, you know, kindness. And they have a very intense family connection, very traditional. They follow their traditions. Like the young man that was our guide, he's getting married in October, and he explained the marriage ceremony to us, which goes on for a week.
Wow.
And the whole village participates, and her village comes, and she rides in on a camel. And so it was really neat to hear about all their traditions. Even though these are, you know, people in their 30s, and they're listening to rock and roll, and they're dressed in jeans, and, you know, they're trendy looking. But then at times they would pick us up, and they were in their caftans and their turbans, and that's what they're actually more comfortable in. So if they're in the city, they look like the city, but when they're in the desert, they dress like the desert. So, but they're very, very proud people. And actually in Marrakesh, they just opened a Berber museum, which we had the opportunity to go to. That was really amazing, whoever put that together, because you don't realize that the Berber, the nomadic tribes of Africa, have been around for thousands and thousands of years, and all different tribes, and they have gathered things together. So that was really educational. So, yeah.
Well, we're just about out of time, but if you'd like to book a trip, Kathy Takushi, Captivating Journeys, 244-1414, 244-1414 can help you, and all this knowledge is gathered so that you can have an experience that's uniquely yours. There's a reason it's called Captivating Journeys. It provides adventures. I mean, trips like this should be a trip of a lifetime. And it should expand your horizons. You should learn and make friends and experience the real place and cultures that bring people together through peace and understanding. So thank you, Retta Evolution, and thank you, Kathy. Thank you, Sue, so much, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.